Happy 2011, everybody. Kathy Brooks here. If you've listened to Social Media Hour over the last, say, year and a half, well, it's changed. Social Media Hour is no longer. You're now listening to The Conversation. You can hear the new theme music. That's cause and effect, because everything that we do has an immediate and, of course, effect, especially in the world of technology. And today, we are going to be, obviously, we're having some technical difficulties this morning, starting with my headset not actually working, so I couldn't hear my guests. I can hear them now, and I will be bringing them on momentarily. Taylor Krause of Voices of Rwanda, he's a longtime journalist who has been spending a lot of time in Rwanda really saving lives by telling people stories and doing that through video. And also have three folks up on the show, Tonya Santiago, Kelly Ferris, and Tony Martin. They just returned from a global globe-trotting expedition sponsored by Coca-Cola called Expedition 206. 2006 would have been a little bit many. But what they did was they went to 206 countries, and they're going to be talking with us about what that experience was all about and, well, what they're going to do with it from here. I'm also just noticing that it tells me I've only got 28 minutes left in the show, so that's strange. So while I bring Taylor live onto the show, I'm going to try and do some magic in the background to extend the show another half hour. Taylor, welcome aboard.
Thanks so much, Kathy. How are you?
Very, very well. Bit of a scattered start to the first episode of The Conversation, but thank you for your patience this morning. Now, you are generally a California guy with your 310 area code number, but you're in New York right now, and I'm guessing you spent a lot of time in Rwanda.
I do. These days I'm trying to trim it down a little bit to about half the year over there, but the last 4 or 5 years have been there maybe three quarters of the year. So most of my time is in Rwanda and the Great Lakes region. And the rest of my time I'm in the U.S. and bouncing around on buses and trains and things.
So talk to me a little bit about what Voices of Rwanda is all about. Now, certainly the genocide in Rwanda from back in the mid-90s, we all heard the stories, and there has been a lot of reconciliation attempted. There have been lots of bringing people to justice, but this is really about telling people's stories. Talk a little bit about how you got started with this and what Voices of Rwanda is all about.
Sure. I'd love to share a little bit about what these testimonies are that we're filming. Voices of Rwanda is an oral history archive, which is to say we film video testimonies of people's life stories. And, I came to Rwanda first in 2004 because I was trained as a documentary filmmaker, and I wanted to go to Rwanda because I wanted to understand a little bit about how the genocide could happen in 1994 in my lifetime. Because at the time, I was working on a film about the Second World War for public television and really internalizing that war and that experience by reading newspaper articles of the time and on microfilm and watching hours of archival footage and really going through hundreds and hundreds of images at the National Archives. And in that process, I really started thinking, well, this is something that is still happening, and I wanted to personally understand it. And so I went with a colleague to Rwanda in 2004 on the eve of the 10th anniversary of the genocide. And, after I spent a few months there, I came back home, and I really didn't know what to do with that experience of being there, of meeting survivors, of meeting people in the country who were living with the legacy of the genocide, though the country had really moved forward. It still had this past to contend with and in very tangible ways. Some of those being, tens of thousands of prisoners being let out of prison and the community having to deal with the implications of that. Others had to do with survivors finding the bones of their family members and having to rebury them. And still others had to do with the justice process. And so this was something that kind of resonated in a really profound way for me back here in the United States, and I didn't know how to move forward with my own life. And what I had hoped to do was to travel around and work on various different films. And so I realized I needed to go back. And that's when I decided that because I was trained as a documentary filmmaker and because I had you know, in college I had listened to testimonies of Holocaust survivors, and I had grown up hearing stories of about the Holocaust, that perhaps this is something I could contribute to in Rwanda. And in 2005, we began establishing this organization, Voices of Rwanda, to do just that, to record testimonies of survivors of the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. And so now, you know, I spend most of my time in Rwanda, and, you know, we're expanding our offices, and hopefully in the coming years we'll be able to open up an office in each province and build this archive.
So as you're building this archive, you know, certainly one of the things about all of the technology that we have today, from, you know, video, which has been around for a while, but now the ability to actually disseminate that content to a far greater audience. You know, it used to be your documentary filmmaker. You know, you made your film. Maybe you got distribution. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you got to festivals. Maybe you didn't. If you were doing testimonials of this nature, maybe you got an outlet for it. But now, you know, through the internet and through the social web, there's such a wide breadth of opportunity to share these stories. But really, when you think about just sharing the stories, what's your greater goal with this? Is it, you know, merely just to make sure that if we forget history, we are certainly condemned to repeat it, as they say. But what about your thoughts on how this can fundamentally change both the way people see what's still actually going on in Rwanda, as well as maybe what might be avoided in the future?
Well, you know, that's a really complicated question, which when I first embarked on the project, I really thought that this was the missing piece. If only people could listen to life stories of Rwandans, if only they could see human beings in Africa instead of just images of starving children, if only there were human beings and we understood that, then we would inherently relate differently to the whole continent, to issues that arose when conflicts began. We would actually engage ourselves differently. Over these past 5 years, I've become very skeptical because I see the way media is used and abused. And unfortunately, the ubiquity of technology, you know, the access to material, really, it could really help things, but also it can really damage things. So it's become
talk a little bit more about what you mean by it could damage things.
What I mean by that is, we all have heard the conversation of becoming desensitized to images of violence, whether it's because of, you know, whether it's because of images in the news or whether it's because of video games. And I'm very concerned that the way we see images actually changes how we engage in them. And so if, for example, testimonies somehow find their way, only 30 seconds of a testimony finds its way to YouTube, then I feel that somehow, yes, it's true, people are hearing about what's happened, but somehow people are able to disengage, because somehow if you hear a story of somebody who's experienced such trauma and tragedy, that this person's arm is cut off and this person lost their whole family, this individual ceases to become an individual in some ways. So what I hope is that through all of these different forms of media, we begin to engage with oral history in a different way and actually invest ourselves in listening in a different way. So yes, the technology can open up that space, a space that didn't previously exist, because you had to conform to certain modes of media, like a film on TV or like a film in a theater. Now you do have options for people to sit down and engage for maybe an hour with a specific testimony and actually see a human being. So I feel like, you know, there is great possibility, but there's also danger. And there's also danger to Rwandans, because Rwanda is a place that has come so far and is very stable right now, but there are still survivors being killed. And there still is a risk that potentially if we expose everybody's, you know, narrative online, and who knows what will happen in the country, potentially it will leave them at risk in the future. So we have to navigate some serious questions when it comes to technology. What we had hoped to originally be a completely open source archive for the world to listen finally has now, you know, we have sort of other challenges that we have to deal with and think through really, really deeply. And we're seeing that in other cases too, when journalists are writing about stories of rape, you know, when they're talking about rape, and if they expose somebody to the public, who knows if that person in that town will be ostracized because of that narrative. And so there are different organizations that work with questions like this and deal with that, and those are things that we have to consider as we move forward.
You know, the thing that comes to mind as you're talking is really it's about thoughtful and mindful use of the technology. You know, we have these loaded guns in our hand, these loaded guns of technology that, you know, handled improperly really can backfire in pretty substantive ways.
Absolutely. I think that's completely true. And one of the ways that I hope our work contributes is to give a complete picture of, you know, an individual's life story, which is nearly impossible. When you sit down and conduct a testimony, and the testimony is an 8-hour-long testimony, of course that can't represent a whole person's life story. But you do get very, very rich narratives about life before the genocide, during the genocide, after the genocide, not just stories of horror. And so you get a fuller picture of what Rwanda was like, down to, you know, a conversation about the new year. Here we are, you know, in the new year. And in Rwanda, the new year is one of the most important holidays. And you know, I wouldn't know this if not for speaking with Rwandans about what happens on the new year. And in the countryside, for people who don't have any money, it's the only time they actually eat meat. It's, you know, a big festival, and everybody comes together and eats meat on the new year, even more important in some places than Christmas. And Rwanda is a very Catholic country, so that's saying a lot. So I think really interesting, you know, historical and cultural elements come through that have nothing to do with the genocide as well.
I want to remind folks that who might be listening that, of course, we want to hear your voices as well. We've got a live chat going on. If you go to blogtalkradio.com/theconversation, you can listen to the live stream. Well, actually, if you're listening to this, you already know that, but there's a little button where you can join the chat room. You can also call us, and we can hear the dulcet tones of your voices by calling 760-695-1106. Again, that's 760-695-1106. If you have thoughts on how technology could be used effectively or warning labels that we might affix to technology in use cases like this, please chime in. If you have questions for Taylor, of course, chime in as well. So, Taylor, let's talk a little bit about you. I mean, your background, you've worked for a lot of the, as we say with air quotation marks, old school media on the broadcast, everybody from the AP, the BBC, PBS, CNN, HBO. I'm sure there are plenty of other acronyms we could stick in there. You trained under Ken Burns, who's one of the most revered documentarians these days. Talk a little bit about what brought you to this. At what point did storytelling become an important aspect of who you are, and did you realize that it was what you wanted to do with your life?
You know, I think this, I was just recently trying to piece together, and I think we all are often looking back at our lives and trying to piece together, how did I get to be here? How did I get to wake up every day, open up my Kinyarwanda English dictionary, and memorize my words? And how did Rwanda become so central in my life? And how did, you know, it's even strange to me. You know, all of a sudden, Rwanda feels like home to me after these years there. And I'm constantly trying to understand, well, how did this come to be? And so I look back, and one of the most important experiences I had was when I was a teen in high school, and I wanted to be a veterinarian. So and someone came into my Spanish class and said, oh, you can do this program, volunteer program, and you can go to South America and vaccinate dogs and cats and learn Spanish. And I went home to my parents and said, hey, I'm going to South America. They said, no, you're not. I ended up volunteering on the program, and I went, and while there in this small town in Ecuador, while I was vaccinating cats and dogs every day, I had this transformative experience of being outside of myself. I was 15 years old, and I was outside of my own culture, and I was, you know, I didn't understand what it was to sit on the porch and sit and talk to people, because my life was so overprogrammed growing up with activities and school events. And finally, I realized that I wanted to somehow share the experience I was having with people back home, and I had no way to do that. And so it was summer really, you know, when I was in high school, I realized, wow, I think maybe I should try to bring a camera and document these things in some way. And I think that was what set me on the trajectory to wanting to study film in college. And then, of course, every step that followed and when I was the beneficiary of certain grants and got to travel with a camera, people began opening themselves up to me in a way that I had never experienced before. And that's really what I find now to be one of the most special things of this work that I do in Rwanda. And everybody who works with us, who has the opportunity to facilitate these testimonies, is that filming a testimony and listening to people as they share about their lives is the most intimate experience I can ever imagine, because I've never before had the experience in regular life where I can sit down with somebody and they'll talk with me and talk to me and talk at me for, you know, 8 to 10 hours about the most intimate things in their lives. And that is this really special experience that I think changes us. And in many ways, that's what I hope for this archive to do in the long term, is if we find those spaces, be it online or in an archive that's accessible in different ways, that people do have that opportunity to engage across thousands of miles and across different cultures and language barriers to finally sit down and listen to another human being and learn from them and learn about themselves in the process. And that is why I do this work ultimately.
Yeah, and Frida in the chat room actually had mentioned, I think it's relevant to what you just said, that, you know, and she said, engaging with a human being in Rwanda online will connect us closer, don't you think? If I could converse with a woman one-on-one from there, I would be more connected than a news-style format where people are just icons. So there is this idea that by connecting with people that you get that chance. You know, I want to touch quickly, though, on what you were talking about, this aspect of people sharing their intimate lives with you. You know, interviewing is very hard, especially in this kind of interview. You know, these very deeply personal, deeply intimate, you know, people who have gone through extreme tragedy and trauma, especially. Talk a little bit about what you do to prepare yourself. Kind of, how do you get yourself into a place where you can be connected to them and be present, but at the same time maintain enough distance that it doesn't just destroy you?
That's a difficult question, because I also don't know sometimes when that which I'm listening to and the stories that I'm hearing, even if they don't affect me in the same way in that very moment, when I go home at night or a week later or a year later, there are things that stay with me. So I don't know that we can actually distance ourselves in a way to, as you say, protect oneself. But I also know that sometimes hearing the truth is something so important to understanding what this experiment that we call civilization is, that I'm willing to accept the ways that it has changed me and sometimes the ways that I don't like. To protect oneself, I think we do have a lot of kind of processes in the testimony process itself. First of all, if I'm facilitating the testimony, I'm not alone in it. There is an individual who is also with me who's translating, and there are three of us, and we are there together in a room, and we will stop when we need to stop and take a breath and stand up and go for a walk if we need to, and we will be with each other. And I think that's, if we can remember that we are there as three people in a room together, we can get through it. And sometimes people get through their testimonies without ever shedding a tear, and they are so proud of having done so because they felt very comfortable. So we try to create a really comfortable atmosphere as well, where we meet these individuals before the testimony process, and we share even a bit of ourselves and why we are there, so that they understand who we are before they begin to share who they are. And all of these are ways of developing relationships that we consider very sacred, and we follow up. And individuals who have shared their testimonies are not just testimonies to the organization or to all of us who have been part of those processes. They become our friends. And That to me is the most special thing, and what ultimately is, you know, does protect even me from some of the darkest thoughts I have about the world after this, is because I can call these individuals and and speak with them and share in their joys, and you know, that's ultimately very special.
Yeah, and Frida also mentions in the chat room, you know, it's when you think of people who work in places of great trauma, whether it's someplace like an emergency room or people who are therapists who specialize or work with victims of trauma and PTSD, people who have been in, you know, places of war where, I mean, even in my days when I was working, you know, in a newsroom, when I was a kid working in a radio newsroom in Philadelphia, there's an observer distance in those cases that you have to maintain in order to maintain your sanity. But I think that the real beauty of this kind of work that you're doing is that it is so human, that there is such a human contact. I also need to mention, I just glanced into the chat room, and Bill Clinton is in the chat room, or at least somebody who's named Bill Clinton. That's pretty funny. I don't think it's actually. It's not Mr. President, but.
I think it's definitely. I recently had a Rwandan share with me, a survivor share with me, that they found it incredibly important when Bill Clinton apologized for having not had the impetus to actually stop the genocide. And actually, his political apology was very important to them on a personal level. So I think having Bill Clinton in the chat room is actually an interesting reminder of the role of our government and all of these things during the genocide.
Yeah. Well, this Bill Clinton says he has his own sports show. So I'm thinking that it's probably a different Bill Clinton, but that's okay. I do love our former president. So, you know, you also bring up a very interesting point that I think is more than a little relevant about technology, which is we spend so much time with these digitized bits and bytes. We spend so much time communicating. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm about as saturated in the social web as anybody, and probably more than most. I loves me my Facebook. I loves me my Twitter. You know, I'm there every day, all day. And it's a big part of my work and my life. But I'm continually trying to step back from it, thinking about how desensitized, to your point from earlier, this desensitized nature of communication, that we forget that it's about tone of voice. It's about being able to put your hand on someone's arm. It's about looking someone in the eye and taking a moment of pause when something really challenging has taken place.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's not just a black and white picture either. I mean, you asked about even what I do sometimes to prepare for or when I'm engaged in a testimony in filming. And one of the things that I can do when things do get a little bit too much for me to kind of handle on an emotional level in the filming process, I can pull myself backwards just a few inches from directly looking at an individual and begin to look through my camera. And for a brief moment, I have a respite from reality in a strange way. So the device itself becomes a separation in the moment and allows me to breathe because as a trained filmmaker, you know, I'm processing a lot of things at once through the device. I'm processing aesthetics and audio. And so my concerns sometimes are able to switch. And that is also a bit of help sometimes to me. And yet when we screen testimonies outside of Rwanda, sometimes I'm more emotionally, destroyed by watching a testimony of a very dear friend on the screen as opposed to sitting with them in a room and looking at them in the flesh and touching their arm and seeing them smile and seeing them alive. Because in person they are alive, and I can do, as you suggest, touch them and pause, and there we can be together, and they are alive. But on the screen somehow, it's different. This is sort of a different approach, that sometimes it's more powerful to look through the material and sometimes it's less powerful to look through the medium. So I don't think that it's a black and white thing as well.
And I noticed that we have a caller calling us from area code 612. Your last four digits are 5511. What's your name and what would you like to contribute?
Well, Yahoo, this is the President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton, the 42nd President of the United States. How in the hell are you? I'm just calling into your show because...
Quite well, sir.
I'm a Blog Talk whore, and I'm just hanging out here in Times Square. I did my sports show this morning with Cowpoke Radio, and I'm just bored because Bill Hillary is in the White House with Obama. So I figured I'd just check him out for conversation because I like to talk because, you know, I did not have sexual relations
with that woman,
Miss Lewinsky. And you know that. And I'm a true conservative. Those righties, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, they're all out to destroy me and Obama. We want to give you guys free health care and print that money. I don't know why they're after us, but you got a great show, and I appreciate you talking to me. What's on the agenda today, my friend?
Oh, well, Mr. President, I want to thank you for calling in. We are going to be talking with Taylor for a few more minutes, and then we have a couple of fantastic, actually not a couple because that'd be two, so I guess several, which that would be three, global travelers will be joining us momentarily. They were on a tour with Coca-Cola this past year, going to 206 countries. Taylor, I want to talk with you a little bit about travel, you know, in kind of leading into this conversation that we'll have momentarily with Tonio, Kelly, and Tony. You know, they went to 206 countries. I'm guessing Rwanda wasn't one of them. When you think about the global access, when you think about all of the places in the world beyond Rwanda, I mean, I think of the Congo, for example. I think of even South Africa. And places throughout South Africa that have a great degree of challenge. What are your thoughts about how these kinds of voices might spread further?
What are my thoughts about how these kind of voices might be sharing the challenges that all of these countries are facing?
Well, no. Yes, I'd like you to talk on a global scale about how we can just solve how we can come to world peace. No. When I think about what you're doing in Rwanda and this kind of endeavor, how might this scale?
Well, I think we have YouTube today, right? In a lot of countries, we have YouTube, which is in a sense a populist archive. It's a populist oral history archive in some senses that people can sit down and share with the world things that are important to them. Of course, there's a lot of things that people share that aren't important to them too, but what would be amazing would be if people actually had access and could begin uploading their narratives from all over the world, and I do think it would be a way that we could communicate and listen to, and this is already happening. And in 1994, if you think about South Africa was dealing with their own issues and ending apartheid. And if you think about Congo today, people don't even have access to running water or health. And so, of course, technology seems to fall far behind. But if people had access to that, I think the way we engaged would be different. And it wouldn't necessarily be just sending water, which is is one of the most important elements to helping refugees and IDPs and water and food, but also, as we are now talking about, aid complicates things sometimes too. So it would be perhaps a different kind of aid, and it would be a bit more engaged kind of aid and a more engaged conversation. So I certainly hope that oral history in itself does scale, and that perhaps Voices of Rwanda as an archive can serve as a model of what we strive for, a sensitive oral history archive that is, we try to do this work with as much integrity as possible, and each testimony is with as much ownership, individual giving as much to the testimony as they want it to be their own testimony. So I hope that in many ways we do have that possibility as we move forward and the world is connected more and more.
Well, Taylor, I'm going to ask you to stick around a little bit, if you don't mind, as I bring Tony, Tonio, and Kelly to the phone, because I'd love to have you chime in with some thoughts as we talk about global stories, of which, they traveled more than 275,000 miles in the last year, so I'm thinking that they've been to a couple places with some stories, I know, right? just makes my head hurt. All right, so thank you, Taylor Krause of Voices of Rwanda. Sit tight, and I'm glad you'll be sticking around for the rest of the show.
Thanks so much, Kathy.
And from Rwanda to the greater global travel, like I just mentioned, Tony Martin, Kelly Ferris, Antonio, known as Tonio Santiago, were selected to participate in a pretty cool endeavor sponsored by Coca-Cola. It was called Coca-Cola Expedition 206, and the mission was to visit 206 countries and territories where Coca-Cola is sold. Okay, marketing ploy, great. But it's interesting what happens on a journey like this when it's all about seeking out sources of happiness, contacting, connecting with people in all of these places around the world, and talking with them about what makes them happy. They traveled more than 275,000 miles, hit 186 countries, and about 365 days a year after they hit the road, they recently arrived. They arrived on December 30th back in the U.S. at the World of Coca-Cola Museum in Atlanta. There's a museum for Coca-Cola. That's interesting. And I'd like to welcome, we've got all three of them in one place, as if you guys aren't sick enough of each other after a year traveling on the road. Welcome aboard, you guys.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us.
Welcome. So, Tony, Tonio, and Kelly, did you guys know each other at all before this endeavor? I mean, that's a pretty long trip to take with complete strangers.
No, we didn't know each other at all, actually, but I guess you can imagine we know each other pretty well now.
So, Tony, I'll start with you. So you started off in Madrid. You went to you got to 186 countries. So why did you come to this endeavor? What possessed you to do it?
I'm sorry?
What possessed you to do this? You know, you teach, you're a teacher, you're from D.C., you teach in Munich.
It's one of those things where I just kind of couldn't say no to an opportunity like this. It's a dream job, you know. One of the things that I really hold high in my life is happiness and being able to travel around the world and share those experiences with so many people. It was no question. Like, I absolutely had to take the opportunity as soon as I read about it.
And how about you, Kelly? So you in the real world, when you're not trotting around the globe, you're in university. You're from you're in Brussels, not originally from there. But talk a little bit about what brought you to this.
Well, I was in my last year studying my master's in advertising, and I actually got an email from one of my professors who'd heard about this job offer. And there was no question about it. As soon as I read it, I knew that I had to have this. I had to go for it. So it's been my dream forever to travel. So this was basically my dream job right there in front of me. So, yeah, I went for it.
And, Tonio, certainly, last but certainly not least, you're also in university from Mexico City. Talk a little bit about why you chose to do this.
Well, since I was a kid, I always wanted to travel around the world. I read a lot since I was little. And, yeah, that was pretty much my inspiration, and my grandfather as well, my godfather as well. They used to travel a lot. So they were like my role models. So I wanted to travel around the world. And yeah, a friend of mine last year just sent me the application, and I was like, okay. This sounds too good to be true, but okay, I'm going to do it. And I did, and yeah, 1 year later, I'm sitting down here, really happy to be here back home.
So the goal of this, you know, you were called the Happiness Ambassadors, and the goal was you were on a quest to find out what makes people happy. So, Tony, what makes people happy?
Well, you know, it's really funny. It's actually pretty simple. As you go around the world, everybody pretty much has the same answer. The most popular answer you'll ever get is family and friends. And that's what makes people happy up and down the world, all around. Family and friends. After that, I guess in a distant second, third, and fourth, are music, sports, and food. Yeah. But by far the biggest answer, family and friends. And it's really cool because you get to see As much as we always talk about the differences that we have with everyone around the world, everyone wants to try to point out what's different between us. In the end, you know, we have a lot more similarities than we do differences.
Well, and it's funny, nowhere in that list you mentioned was money.
You know, it's funny as well because it definitely didn't even make the top 10 or top 20. And when people did say money, for the most part, they were speaking about money to get freedom, to be able to travel where they wanted to be able to go to the places and do the things they wanted to. Not really money in the sense for material possessions. And I would say that a lot of the poorest people that we met were some of the happiest.
Hmm. There's something to that, I think.
I agree.
So what was the biggest surprise for you? Kelly, what was the biggest surprise for you on this trip?
Surprise? Well, I don't know. I enjoy being surprised. I enjoy going to a country and not knowing much about it and then just being surprised by what I see and by the people and the openness of the people. That's something that I really enjoyed discovering, all of these different cultures. I love it. I love discovery.
Tony, how about you? Any big surprises for you on this journey?
Yeah, I think the biggest surprise was just, I guess, how much we could endure as a team, number one. I mean, as you could imagine, the trip got really crazy just with schedule and lack of sleep. But I think that the biggest surprise for me was to realize no matter where we went, how poor a country could be, how absolutely run down in places like Rwanda, like we actually did go there. No matter where we went, we always found people who were willing to share with us, who were kind to us, who were willing to show us what made them happy. And no matter where we went, we always found those examples of happiness, even in the places where you would least expect. And that was a huge surprise to me because, you know, you expect to find some places where everybody just has to be miserable. But it's just not the case. Everywhere we went, we were finding glaring examples of happiness and really cool people everywhere we went.
So you said, and first let me ask you, Tonio, any surprises for you along the way?
Pretty much what the guy said already. I mean, we get the chance to experience on a daily basis different cultures, different ways of perceiving life and things. But of course, like Tony said in the beginning, what was really cool is that regardless what, by the end of the day, we have more things in common. And that was really, really cool and really interesting to see. And of course, as well, like, we got the chance to although it was for a short time because we couldn't spend a lot of time in every single country, but we get the chance to get to know really engaging cultures, really, really different from what you're used to, for instance, in the Pacific or in the Middle East or in Africa. So, yeah, I would say that.
So I'll be bringing, since I was not aware that you did go to Rwanda, I will bring Taylor back on in a moment. But I want to ask a little bit about structurally how this worked because, you know, you're going to all of these countries. Was it just the three of you guys and your suitcases? Was there, you know, an entourage following you? Were there kind of like, how was it set up?
It was just the three of us traveling to each country, most of the time with our luggage. A lot of the times our luggage got misplaced, but yeah, it was just the three of us from country to country. Once we get to certain countries, I'd say in a lot of the countries, probably about 70 or 80% of the countries, we had local hosts from the local Coca-Cola office, from the local market, that would show us in our short amount of time basically what the happiness was in that country and give us chances to share with people. Chances that we wouldn't normally be able to have. But there were a lot of countries as well where we were on our own, where we didn't have, you know, any support. We just show up and, yeah, hopefully have our luggage most of the time.
So I'd love to bring Taylor into the conversation now. You know, Taylor, certainly you having spent as much time in Rwanda specifically as you did, you know, happiness, I would imagine, is a pretty crucial part of, you know, of hope and people trying to survive through the kinds of things that they did in Rwanda. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. I think it is a survival mechanism in many ways, and it's a human experience that we can't deny, no matter how difficult the circumstances are. And it's not always a linear thing. For example, a friend of mine who's a survivor in Rwanda, when she presented her testimony, it was a very, very difficult testimony to get through. And a few years later, she had a baby. And having the baby brought her so much joy that now she wasn't alone in the world in terms of her family lineage, that now if we were to go back and conduct a testimony, the way that she presents her own life story, I believe, would be very different because of the kind of happiness that she's getting on a day-to-day basis. And, that came years later, 16 years later, but it was something that eventually she was able to survive through with the hope that she could rebuild her family. And that hope, when it was fulfilled, brought her so much happiness.
So, Tonio, talk a little bit about your time in Rwanda specifically. How long were you there, and what did you do while you were there?
We were only there for one night. We didn't have a lot of time. We had a pretty hectic schedule throughout Africa to go to all of these countries. But what I can tell you is that what we found out, and with the persons we talked to, what they told us is that, of course, after going through really rough times, one of the things that makes them really happy is to live peacefully, and to have the chance to enjoy small things in life without having to worry about their security and other things,
Tony, Kelly, what are your further thoughts about your experiences in Rwanda, as well as what other countries in Africa you visited?
Like Antonio said, it's surprising how many African countries, what happiness would mean to them is something that we would take for granted, where they just say, hey, peace and stability is something that really makes them happy. But it was also really cool to see, because when we got to Rwanda, even though we were there for only one night, it was also around the time of the World Cup. And so you see everybody going crazy for soccer. You see people going around in the streets, kids playing on dirt fields with balls and stuff like that. And it was really cool to just see that despite everything, to watch a group of people move in a positive direction. And you see that a lot in a lot of the African countries. But, we took a road trip from Togo to Benin. It took us like 3 hours. And on the way, I just decided to sit down and just take notes on all the moments of happiness I saw. And I filled up several pages, just all the little details, people on the side of the roads, playing with kids, mothers throwing kids in the air, catching them, people after a hard day's work sitting under shade, small kids running barefoot, playing soccer in dirt fields. I mean, there's so many things. And we actually had someone tell us that they believed that we would find happiness more in the poorer countries because they've learned to let go of their desire for material possessions. So the things that they hold close to them are the things that are really, honestly, the most important in life. And they can cut out all the other stuff that really is inconsequential and really concentrate on the things that are really key to happiness. So it's really cool that you go to a place like this and you find that happiness is even stronger than what you see in a lot of developed countries.
A couple of interesting questions from Frida in the chat room. Some tactical questions. So what kind of cameras, what kind of gear were you carrying around with yourself?
Well, we had our iPhones and our Blackberries. That was for like short clips and pictures. We had an HD camera.
Canon
HD camera. You had...
I've also got a Canon 5D Mark II for still pictures.
I had the Rebel T1i Canon as well. And Kelly had a...
I had a Nikon D5000.
Yeah.
Okay. I think the iPhone was the most important piece of gear.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the gender breakdown of the people that you talked to, did you talk to mostly men, mostly women, a little bit of both, even split?
Pretty even split. I mean, we talked to anyone who was willing to share with us, man, woman, child, whatever, you know, we weren't really looking at being at the demographic. For us, it was just about sharing with whoever was willing.
Where else in Africa did you go specifically? Like, I don't expect you to list all 186 countries, but give us an idea of where you went.
Okay, I can tell you. We went from the top of my head. We went to Ghana, Gambia, Senegal, South Africa.
Southern Africa, East Africa, West Africa, North Africa, just the middle part. We missed a few countries there. We missed Chad, Central Africa,
Nigeria, because we didn't get the visas in time.
Yeah.
But pretty much the rest of Africa.
Yeah,
we
pretty much the entire outer ring.
Yeah.
So an excellent question actually tossed in to me from Taylor in an IM about, has this trip made you guys happier people, or, you know, in some way, has witnessing some of the pain that you've seen along the way complicated it?
No, definitely happier. Seeing all this happiness around the world, sharing with all these people, even putting things into perspective in our own lives, that it's been something that's really brought us a lot of peace of mind and a lot of happiness.
Yeah, and especially when you go to countries that they've been through, like, really rough times, and you get the chance to share with the people from that country, and they show you a different way of perceiving life. And you get to realize that sometimes you come from a privileged background and you're complaining about so many different things, and they may have little or close to nothing, and they perceive life in a much more positive way. So that was a huge lesson, and definitely that has contributed to my own happiness.
What about you, Tony?
I mean, I definitely have to agree with Antonio. Like, you know, you talk about, or you ask about, you know, compared to some of the suffering we've seen, has it brought us down or lifted us up? We have, you know, been around so many situations, positive and negative, but each of those situations has served to make us happier people, because when we see the negative side of life, it makes us appreciate what we have. And of course, when we see the positive, we get to share and have fun. And we've just had some absolutely amazing experiences. It's really been all about the people. That's what the whole campaign has always been about. It's about the people and the relationships. And when your job and your task to basically travel around the world and have fun, you know, to experience people's happiness, it really lifts your spirits. You know, and you go and someone says, my happiness is surfing one of the greatest waves in the world. Here, I'll take you out there on a jet ski. You know, like, it really... It does a lot to how much you enjoy life, and one of the things that I took from this is definitely the relationship, the perspective that I get from all the different type of people we shared with. I think one good example that's really simple is in Senegal, they have this tea that they drink, and everybody drinks it. You go in the corners, everybody's drinking this tea. They're selling it everywhere. And they usually only have two cups because it's a shared thing. And we found this university where, I guess, 15 to 20 guys after school hang out under this tree, and they have a little propane tank, and they cook this tea. And then they pass these two cups around over and over again. And we asked them, like, hey, you know, this seems like, you know, a happy moment for you guys. Do you mind if we share it with you? And they welcomed us into their family, their Kikindo family, as they called it. And we just sat there for hours, just laughing and joking and sharing tea. And the guy looks at us and he goes, this right here is our happiness. You know, we sit here and we talk about life, we talk about our struggles, we get everything off our chest, we hang with our family, we laugh it off, and we feel better about everything afterwards. And it was such a special thing to be able to share that with them, and at the same time share their perspective and hopefully leave a little bit of ours as well. And I think that those things have no choice but to uplift you. To make you a better, even more positive person.
You know, I want to just chime in here because I really respect that you guys have, you know, just traveled around the world and at the pace at which you've done it is, you know, unconscionable. I don't even know how I could ever keep up with that, you know, carrying suitcases and the different languages. And it's pretty amazing what you guys have done as a team. But what I would add is what you, what unfortunately it sounds like you miss in moving so quickly, is you really miss sometimes elements when people open up to perhaps they did, to the deep sorrow that persists, that the rosy picture that one can express about passing of tea in Senegal is not always the rosy picture at the end of the day. And in fact, there is tragedy staring us in the face all the time. And to walk away from a trip like this and to feel happier somehow is complicated to me. It somehow doesn't resonate with my own experience of traveling around the world and confronting the world, because every time I confront the world, I come home and I feel even sadder than I ever went out in the world. Yes, there are moments of beauty and happiness that I experience to greater heights, but also that experience of sadness reminds me of how mammoth the task is at hand to contribute to solving some of these huge global issues. And so I don't walk away from experiencing the world happier person. I walk away from it being a much more, complicated and sadder person, perhaps. So it's interesting to see the different experiences we've had.
What would you guys say to that?
I think that that makes me sad for you, man. Like I think that you know, it's all about what each of us take from it, you know. And you know, you look in the news every day and you see all types of tragedies. You see all types of things that are going wrong with the world, but it's not very often where people go out or endeavor to go out and find, the positive and bask in it. And that's what this campaign was really all about. And yeah, you can let, all those things that you talked about really get inside of you and really make you a sadder person. But that wasn't really what our journey was about. Our journey was about the happiness. And so it was much easier for us to come home and feel happy about what we did, because throughout the entire process, we're sharing and having wonderful times with people. And yes, we did see bad things, but in contrast, in places where we expected to see bad things, we saw great things. And in places where we did see bad things, we saw signs of hope. And we chose to hold on to that.
Let's be clear, though, that you guys were sent out on a mission, to engender a positive feeling about, you're sent out on a mission by an organization that gave you an amazing opportunity, but you're sent out on a mission to kind of experience only the positive, it sounds like.
Well, we're searching for happiness. That's definitely our job. We're going around the world trying to find out, and not just find out, but to share and also spread as well happiness. And it wasn't like we were just asking people every day, what makes them happy. We're sharing these experiences, and we're also doing our best to spread smiles and spread the love from our end along the way. So, that definitely is our job. Just as you choose as your job, you're going and you're trying to tell these stories, which I think is really, really extremely important that people get to hear this. And so as a part of your job, you're immersing yourself in those really sad moments, and I think there's a place for both sides, and I think it's just two sides of the same coin. Like you really have to have both of those things. I think that's kind of why you come away with sadder feelings, is because you are choosing to tackle that other side of the coin, which, like I said, definitely needs to be tackled. Like those stories definitely need to be told.
Actually, I would posit in between there that there's an opportunity, and this leads to the question that I'd like to ask you, Tony, Tonio, and Kelly as well. In talking with Taylor earlier, he did make a point of talking about that it's not just about the tragedy, but that there is a lot of hope and happiness and positive through that, especially those people who have managed to survive and are not just surviving but thriving in the aftermath of atrocities. But the question that I'd have for you, so you've gone on this tour, you've been to all these countries, you've chosen to focus on the happiness part, which is great. What do you do with this from here? How can this be put to some sort of greater value or use so that it isn't just the rosy picture? Because let's face it, the rose-colored glasses were smacked off most of our heads a long time ago. The world is not just a happy, bright, shiny, happy place. There's a lot of darkness in the world. And yes, there's a lot of happiness, and focusing on the positive is a good thing to do, but it doesn't discount the fact that the negative is actually there. So the question that I posed to you in just a few moments that we have left is, what do you do with this from here, and how do you take this trip and further engender happiness and address some of those issues, perhaps through the happiness filter?
All right. I think that, you know, where we go from here is, you know, we're taking all the things that we've learned, and we have really honestly been trying to use that knowledge to help the people that we come across that are still trying to search for that answer. And we have, like you said before, I mean, it's all about social media. We started this huge social media project and been sharing all the content along the way on our website, expedition206.com, and really trying to show people all around the world what we found out. But then also to do it on a personal level, you know, just like I'm sure Taylor does as well, like, you know, he has these videos that he shares through social media, but also sharing those stories with the people that you meet along the way to kind of pass on that story. And so when we're out there and we're living our daily lives, we have a fresh, new, distinct perspective that we approach everyone we talk to with. And when we see people who are not quite on the right path, you know, we kind of try to pass on that knowledge as well. And the things that we learn, I mean, you're right, the rose-colored glasses have been smacked off a long time ago, but I think that through the right perspective, you can get those back.
Kelly, Tonio, would you have something you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I agree there's a lot of sad stuff out there, and we're seeing that every day on the news and everywhere. And I think it's good to also remember that there's good stuff out of there and to have that perspective and to share that and to tell people, you know, you've got to stay positive and help out where you can, but you can't save everyone, you can't save the world. But if you do give a little back, I think that's the main thing.
Tonio, how about you?
Yeah, definitely. I do understand what were you saying, and definitely one way for you to know what happiness is, you gotta know as well sadness. And yeah, one thing that I've learned, and I think we've learned throughout this year, is that everyone has to, well, I can speak for myself. I should try to, with whatever I have, try to be as good as possible and try to give back. I mean, this is something I've been telling over and over again. I think that we were somehow gifted with this whole journey. We had the chance to see a lot of different persons, a lot of different scenarios, a lot of different things. And I think that after this is over, we're going to try to come up with a way of giving back everything we received throughout this. So, yeah, I think that's pretty much it.
Excellent. Well, with that, I want to thank my guests. I think we could probably talk about happiness for many hours. Although I'm sure that Tony, Tonio, and Kelly maybe are a little sick of happiness after the last year. I want to thank my guests today, Taylor Krause of Voices of Rwanda, Tony Martin, Kelly Ferris, and Tonio Santiago from the Happiness Ambassadors from the Coca-Cola Expedition 206. And I want to thank all of you guys for listening to the first episode of The Conversation. We're going to be looking at technology much as we did on Social Media Hour in the next year, but really focusing on the people behind the technology, the people who build it, the people who market it, and the people who are using it. So if you've got any ideas, you want to suggest people to talk to, suggest some story ideas, by all means, pass those along. You can reach me at Kathy@otherthanthat.com. You can also reach me via Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/theconversation. I want to thank you for listening. Thank you for being present. And go be happy. Have a great week, everybody.